Hey there, it's Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli, and I want to chat with you about a key ingredient for a fabulous date night, feeling sexy. And come on, let's be real. What you wear plays a big part in how you rock that confidence. That's why I'm thrilled to introduce you to Quince. Quince brings you premium European linen dresses, blouses, and shorts starting at just $30, along with washable silk tops, 40-karat gold jewelry, and more. And guess what? All of their goodies are priced 50 to 80% lower than similar brands. By teaming up directly with top factories, Quince skipped the middleman and hands us the saving. Plus, they stick to factories with safe, ethical practices and top-notch fabrics and finishes. How awesome is that? Picking from Quince's website was tough, because they have a ton of fabulous choices. I ended up going for their 100% washable silk sleep dress in champagne. And let me tell you, my husband was floored. He's convinced whoever rocks this is in for a blast. I'm going to record some content on that dress so you can see how fabulous is that dress. Elevate your date night style with Quince. Pop over to quince.com/sexology for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/sexology to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/sexology.
Welcome to Sexology, a podcast that untangles the science of sex and pleasure. And now, with this week's episode, your host, clinical psychologist, Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli.
Hello there. Welcome to another episode of Sexology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli. I'm recording this episode at the first day of summer. Super excited for this new season. I was born during summer and I love summer activities. Specifically, two things that I do during summer, if you know me, is doing lots of biking by the beach and reading on the beach. And specifically, I love erotica, reading erotica, romance novels on the beach. I'm kind of low on the books that I have on my list. So if you are reading this different erotica that you love, I appreciate if you send me the information. You can send it to my social media and tag me at Oasis2Care, or you can email me, Dr. Mo'oli at sexologypodcast.com. Can't wait to hear what you're reading. Today, we're going to talk about BDSM. We had various episodes around power play BDSM. We had Midori in the show talking about BDSM. But this episode, we're going to talk about what and how to navigate if your partner is into BDSM and you identify as vanilla or other way around. Few weeks ago, I came across this journal article on Sexuality and Culture Journal, and the title was Vanilla and Kink, Power and Communication Marriages with a BDSM Identifying Partner, which one of the authors was Dr. Kat Meyer. And I thought this is fantastic because this is an issue that I see, and I guess a struggle that I see in my practice, that sometimes people coming in because one partner is identifying as having kinky desires, or they identify as someone who is into BDSM, and the other partner doesn't like it. They kind of think they're vanilla. They don't want to try things. And they come into therapy to kind of see how to navigate that. And I didn't know that there was research studies on that. That's why I thought, oh my God, I got to have Dr. Kat Meyer in our show. So this is the topic we're going to explore today. Dr. Kat Meyer is a licensed couple therapist, sex therapist, yoga instructor, published researcher, and Reiki practitioner dedicated to evolving the relationship we have surrounding sexualities and our bodies. I leave a link to her private practice in the website. She also is a co-creator of Goddess Celebration, an annual large-scale Women's Day related held in Malibu, California. Very cool that she's also has her own podcast. I didn't know about that, which we have so many things in common, which is called Eat, Play, Sex. I leave a link in the show notes to her podcast as well. And without further ado, here's Here's my conversation with Dr. Kat Meyer. Hello and welcome to another episode of Sexology Podcast. I am so excited to have a therapist and also researcher, Dr. Kat Meyer, in our show. Dr. Kat, welcome to our show.
Hi, my pleasure.
I am so excited to have you on the show because I feel like we didn't have enough episode on BDSM. And that's one of those topics that I get lots of questions around. We had Midori talked about it last year, but I know that you published on this topic. This is something that you're very familiar with. So this is definitely an exciting topic to talk about. I'm excited for it. So tell me, you know, when it comes to BDSM, at times there are some misconception. People, they don't know what does a BDSM relationship look like? What are some of the things that people do in their relationship? Mm-hmm. So can you tell us more about that?
Sure. And that's such a loaded question, first of all.
Like a two-year conversation. Yeah.
No, I love it. It's great. I'm ready to dive in. So BDSM stands for bondage, discipline, or dominance, sadomasochism. And it's a, you know, it's really up to the people. It can be a lifestyle, meaning that it's something that they do in the home, or it's something that they, the way that they live their lives in a way of incorporating, whether it's kink or whether it's power play or sensation play. But then it can also be something that you do in what we call the scene or the community, where you play outside with other people and play with them, as in engaging in these sexual or power dynamics, or it's just being a part of the community. So I would say it's a vast range of expression. And
as you said, it can be a lifestyle, like 24/7, or it could be a part of people's kind of like sexual play.
Right, right. So some people identify it as, this is who I am, this is my sexual identity. Or some people identify it as, this is something that I do, this is something that I engage in, this is how I see more of my erotic map, so to say. This is what gets me off.
That makes sense. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, it really is up to the individual or up to the couple how they want that particular identity to manifest itself, and up for them to decide, what are our rules around this? How do we want this to look? How much time do we want to engage in this? Do we want to invite, you know, include other people? Do we want this to not be sexual and just be, you know, playing out these roles of these characters that we take on, or these power differentials that we take on?
And then I love that, again, you're talking about the range. I was at ASAC conference, and I know the presenter, one of the presenters was talking about how it is kind of power play and kind of like power dynamics part of every relationship, right? So with your spouse, with kind of your lover, there are always some elements of power play. So it seems like in some of these individuals who are kind of like practicing kinky behavior or BDSM or in a BDSM relationship or as their orientation, it's amplified. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would say it's more of like a clearly communicated and brought to the forefront. So it's intentional, right? If we already have power differentials in our relationships that we're not even aware of, how the power of influence of one of our partners over the other, depending on our life circumstances or where we're at on some sort of social hierarchy or how much money we make, you know, all of these things influence the power that we bring into the relationship. And here in BDSM, we're saying, okay, we're intentionally setting this up. You intentionally have more power, so to say, than I do. Now, what's interesting is that there, even though we're setting that intention that there's more power with, you know, sometimes we look at somebody as a master would have more power over somebody who's a submissive or a slave. But what we also see is that the person who's a submissive has just as much power, if not more, in that, in the negotiation, because they're able to say how far we actually go, or they're the ones that designate, okay, this is too much, or keep going, kind of thing. So it's very communicated, and there's a constant interaction with that element of power.
Absolutely.
And it's not taboo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the point that I was trying to make with saying that it's part of every relationship is sometimes we have, like human being, have this kind of stigma when it comes to things that are not part of our intentional practice. We're thinking about, oh my God, what's wrong with these people that they're doing this? But we don't know that that's something that we do, maybe unintentionally, unconsciously, or we enjoy. Sometimes what I notice is that people have this aversion toward other people's kind of what they found like erotic and their erotic template. And it can be helpful if they see that, oh, well, there is an element of what they do that they already like. Or I practice. Oh, maybe I'm not necessarily kind of doing a 24/7 BDSM, but I might like blindfold, or I might like a spanking is something that I do with my partner. I might identify as someone who does vanilla sex, but we kind of adopted these things that are could be part of the kink culture. Does that make sense?
Oh my God, so much. And you just brought up such a beautiful example there, because we're influenced by the socially constructed idea of what sex is. And we don't understand that again, it's so vast and it changes, and our sexual potential is infinite if we allow it to be so. Mm-hmm. But if we keep seeing, you know, what is given to us in the media or books, or what is, you know, quote unquote normal and healthy, and we look at BDSM or we look at some of these other styles of sexuality or lifestyle and compare it to that, then of course it's going to be like, oh, well, that's not okay. This is okay. That's not okay. But what's interesting is that we can get sexually stimulated or turned on by some of these elements that we've deemed quote unquote unhealthy or fit in the BDSM world. Like you said, the blindfolds or being taken, or like how many times I've seen in books where the concept of being ravished or taken or, you know, bonded or, you know, some of us like our booty slapped and, and yet some of these elements are in BDSM. So I think it's this mental construct of like, we're separating and we have trouble with the integration of the two. Well, how can I be turned on by this, but it's wrong? So I shouldn't be turned on by this. And that creates a lot of shame and other and separateness.
And judgment toward yourself and others. So yeah. I can talk about this forever, but I want to make sure we can talk about other things BDSM related, because I get tons of questions from our listeners. Mm-hmm. So if there are like new lovers, that one of the lovers, they know that like they are into BDSM and they are kind of like, they want to disclose it to the partner. Yeah. So when is a good time to talk about it if you are into BDSM?
As soon as you can. As soon as you understand that that's something that you're even curious about, or if this is something that you have explored before, you know, letting your partner know and coming at it from a place of, this isn't actually a big deal. This is simply me revealing myself so that they have the opportunity to co-create a sexual script with me, or decide that this isn't for them and they can move on, and we can both continue to create the exact sex and love life that we want. The more that we don't disclose that, then we're being inauthentic and we're not able to fully relax into who we are. And then we can end up holding resentment towards the other person. Well, why aren't you allowing me to be authentic? I'm holding this against you, right? So the sooner in a relationship we can talk about this and bring it forth, then the sooner we can bring both of our sex scripts that are different in together to formulate. And that's one thing I think people forget, is that we all have our own individual sexual scripts or erotic blueprints or maps, so to say. And they aren't necessarily the same when we come into a relationship. So we either naturally co-create something together, or we hit up against these walls and we have to discover what is my script and what is yours, so that we can layer elements of what we like together, so we can get both of our needs met, instead of me putting aside my and my eroticism for the sake of yours, because I guarantee you we will have resentment around that.
I see a lot of that in therapy sessions that I do, and I bet you do too, that people are thinking, they're feeling shame around their sexuality and things they want, or they don't feel it's okay to talk about their desires and their needs, and years pass by, and that kind of causes some resentment and frustration impacting the relationship. So I love that you're talking about, as soon as people kind of feel comfortable to kind of talk about it with their partner, that that would be a good time to talk about it. And I think other thing that you mentioned that was very helpful was to kind of not make a big deal about it, kind of talking more about what you like and kind of exploring what the partner thinks. Do you usually recommend people kind of say the kind of the entire scope of what this is what I like, or kind of like talk about it in a kind of small doses or kind of specific ways?
Well, I would say treat it as something that is a fun exploration. You know, if you create the mindset of curiosity and fun exploration, then the dialogue is going to be that as well. So we can bring forth I'm so curious about what your erotic map looks like. One of the things that really gets me riled up is this, this, and this. What is that for you? What kind of things really turn you on or make you feel really juicy? And have this be a continual dialogue. It doesn't have to be that we put everything out onto the table all at once, mm-hmm. right? Why are we in such a rush there? But to open the conversation early on and allow that to be a, draw it out and enjoy the unfolding.
Right. And I love the term co-creating, because our sexual experiences can be different with different partners, because you are creating this experience, which might be different than what you had with previous partners, because every person come in with their erotic blueprint. And this is hopefully a shared experience that they are creating together. So I know that you did this wonderful study. It was very impressive, because I never hear about studies on sex and sexuality. So tell us, based on your study, how couples communicate and negotiate the rules and expectation about their sexual relationship when one partner is not necessarily into the BDSM culture?
Yeah, there were multiple ways. So one of the things that I saw across the board is the couples that I studied had done some sort of therapy, first and foremost. And if we can, whether that was individual therapy or whether it was couples therapy, but allowing somebody, a third party, to hold a container for us to be vulnerable and say these things that are on our mind, trusting that that a professional can help navigate and translate for us can be really, really helpful, because these conversations can be scary. We're putting out something that is about who we are, and we're not sure how it's going to land, and we're not sure how it's going to, even if our partner loves us, it may activate something inside of them. You know, it may trigger their stress response or surpass their threshold of emotional tolerance. And that doesn't mean that they don't like us or that they, you know, are rejecting us, but they don't know, they get dysregulated and they don't know how to hold us in that. So therapy, number one.
Amen to that.
Also, the partners of the non-identifying partners were able to see that this is part of something that fulfilled them, that made them feel whole, that made them feel, allowed them to be who they are. And they understood that they can't be the all encapsulating source of their fulfillment, meaning that there are some things that we're not going to be able to meet in the other person. There's going to be a lot that we can, but to place the responsibility for us to do all of their needs is unfair on us and unfair for them. So in that regards, there was also a lot of communication. Some of the couples set up weekly check-ins, and I call this State of the Union addresses. Where we get to come together and have a statement about our union, what's working, what's not working. Some of the couples all of them actually did some sort of research. So the person who was identifying with the BDSM would bring books or would do a lot of research online and bring that forth to the person who wasn't identifying and involving them, including them. In most of the couples, the non-BDSM identifying person would also do their own research, but that wasn't the case across the board. But there was at least this level of let me help you understand what's going on inside of me so that you're not stuck with just the stories that your mind is creating here, mm-hmm. using, you know, past understandings or misunderstandings from, again, the socially constructed idea of what BDSM means and what sex means. So that was really powerful and created a shared experience. And then also, I repeatedly saw the couples in going to events together mm-hmm. to check things out. So if somebody wanted to be more in the scene, and not all of the couples wanted to, but sometimes they wanted to be in the scene, they would have their partner go with them and explore, view other people, experience what it's like to be in that space, to be in the palpable energy, and to get to know some of the other people who were there so that it was less threatening and they could really feel that and see that that people who are in the scene aren't necessarily deranged or something wrong with them, mentally ill, that they're awesome people, and the communication with the community is really powerful. I also saw a lot of this was interesting. One element that couples wish that they had was more support mm-hmm. as they navigated through this. Some people felt isolated because they didn't feel that they could go to their friends or go to their family, their typical support system, to be able to talk about the feelings that were coming up. Mm-hmm. So I remember one couple, the non-identifying partner found a support group for that, which is amazing. She was in an urban setting, so that was possible. But even finding support online, so whether it's finding an online chat or maybe you make friends with somebody who is in the scene, going to Munches, which is a non-fetish wear, like I guess regular clothes wear event where you can go and you can ask questions and you can get to know people in the scene without having the intimidating images or, you know, toys or dungeon activities going on around you. But you can sort of relax into that is another really powerful experience that I saw. And then finally, some of these couples, some of them had developed an open relationship. Mm-hmm. Some of them maintained a monogamous relationship. Some of them, the identifying partner would go forth and engage in scenes or play with other people, but not sex. So that was, every couple made up their own rules. They negotiated and came to their own shared rules and understandings of how they wanted to navigate this. And that was just one of them.
Well, I love these points and so many great tips and findings that you shared with us based on your study. I guess I had a couple questions about these couples that you studied. Were they kind of end up being in 24/7 kind of dynamic, or you mentioned some of them are kind of opened up their marriage. So what was the kind of the end result that you found that like these couples in your study navigated this difference that they had in the kind of erotic template?
Yeah, and it was different for everybody. Everybody's relationship manifested differently. So there was some couples where they were still working through it, where they would play some together in the bedroom, but they weren't at the point where they wanted the partner to do that outside. But it still wasn't their preferred, you know, the non-identifying BDSM person, it still wasn't their preferred way of having sex, but it was, some of the elements they were okay with. And it was more of like, okay, well, we both, and this actually was across the board, everybody, each of the partners enjoyed vanilla, regular sex mm-hmm. with their partner. So that was solid. That was good. It was more of the identifying partner wanted, you know, more of what was fulfilling for them and their identity. And so some of them, again, had more of like a poly situation where they had whole relationships outside that fulfilled the BDSM portion of who they are. Some people had where it was just, okay, the identifying partner would go forth and have, you know, do scenes with people, mm-hmm. but would never have sex with them and would never engage sexually with them. So there was a lot of trust there. And it was like, okay, and then you come back and you're with me and everything's great. This is just a part of you that you feel you want to go have fulfilled. Yeah. So it was really a process for each of them to come to a conclusion. A lot of trying things out, a lot of things not working, a lot of things working, a lot of things working over time. And again, it was them keep coming back, seeing what works, renegotiating what didn't work, and trusting each other.
Right. And I love that you mentioned that there were different ways that people navigated this differences. It seemed like some people were kind of like curious and they found it exciting that they incorporated. And some people, after trying, they figure out it's not for them. And perhaps they thought about different ways that the partner can get that kind of sexual desire fulfilled with open marriage or open relationship or polyamory. Because sometimes what I see in my practice that couples are coming in, they want to kind of incorporate like BDSM or kinky behavior, and the other partner who is not identifying with that with those things coming in just because of fear of abandonment. They say we want to do the work, but there's just like huge resentment there. I'm kind of curious if you see that at times.
You know, I think the way that I frame things, not as much, because I talk to people about learning what their erotic language is and teaching it in a way of, we just don't know yet what our partner's language is until we start exploring these things. And so as I describe to them, as we get to know the types of words that turn our partner on, the types of actions or roles that we can all take on, and I explain to them, you know, some of us are more sensual, so we like contouring types of touch, or we're really turned on by cuddles or or by, you know, sensory connections in the environment. Some of us are more sexual, so we're more focused on the orgasms and we're turned on by more of this rougher type of engagement. And some of us are more of these energetic, tantric, you know, style of people. And so we like things that are more of like hovering, or we like more like flowery, energetic words like yoni or lingam and that kind of thing. And so when we approach it in a way of these maps that are intricate and combine all these different elements, then we can understand, okay, let's incorporate some of this and layer it with that. So both of our needs are met. This may not be, and it's a give and it's a take, right? But it's not completely throwing out our own identity for the sake of the other. And I think so often we get stuck in this black or white thinking. It has to be this or this, and there can't be both. But I see all the time, you know, where we incorporate the element of power play while we have a sensual touch. Mm-hmm. Or we incorporate, you know, some of these, whether it's maybe it's a crop toy mm-hmm. with teasing and hovering of the crop toy mm-hmm. with light touches. So it's like, how can we play with this? And I'm specifically using that word play because play allows for experimentation. It's like trying things out. And if it's not okay, if it doesn't work out, it's okay. It's nothing personal against me or them.
And I think that's why, as you mentioned, coming to therapy is important, because mm-hmm. sometimes we are kind of like so emotionally attached to different things, and we don't know how to communicate these things to our partner because they're emotionally loaded. But mm-hmm. if there is a therapist that can translate these things and different interests and kind of exciting things that you can incorporate in a way that you describe it, versus saying that kind of, this is what I like, take it or leave it kind of situation. If there's a therapist that can help you navigate this and effectively mm-hmm. communicate exactly what is it about this thing that you like, how can I incorporate that? That can be a more constructive conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like, how can we find more compassion for each other mm-hmm. instead of just the separation and the fear aspect of it?
So I'm going to ask you more kind of specific questions when it comes to BDSM. So mm-hmm. tell us, how do they usually negotiate seeing? And for people that are not aware of what's aftercare, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So negotiating the scene, I would say, you know, learning about what it is that you're curious about, you yourself. So a lot of self-inquiry. What is it that I personally want or am curious or want to try? And that's where we can bring forth this into a conversation, right? By knowing self first. And so we can offer some of these ideas of things that we want to try. And then the other person will have the opportunity to say yes or no, or change it in a way that would be more receptive to them. It's in negotiation, we are clear and we are concise, and we're providing so that we can provide consent. We are honest and we provide agency, meaning that we empower each person to make their own decisions for themselves. There's no coercion, so that we can allow for true consent to happen. And there is constant negotiation. So whether it's even within, before a scene, of course, understanding limits, understanding safe words, meaning, you know, like say we want to use pineapple as a word, which is a common safe word, to be what delineates the stop. Mm-hmm. Or maybe we use red in yellow to delineate, you know, red means stop and yellow means slow down or, you know, less pressure kind of thing. But even in that, we can be more direct. We want more, we want harder, we want softer, we want the type of whatever we're doing to be moved to a different location. So it's consistently checking in with ourselves and consistently checking in with the other person. Then, so everybody knows where each other's at the whole time. And it continues to be something that we co-create together in a way that feels safe. Then aftercare is the actions that we take after a scene has ended. So whatever it is, whether it's role playing or whether it's flogging or maybe it's pet play, whatever it is, mm-hmm. afterward, one of the participants will do some sort of action to make the other person feel good psychologically, physically, emotionally, especially if you think about taking on these specific roles that might be taboo or that might be politically incorrect or something that might otherwise stimulate emotional distress in the body, doing some sort of action to counter that and help the person to come down from whatever altered state of consciousness or state that they're in and feel held and loved and cared for. So I remember, you know, bringing up a specific scene for myself, my dom at the time, mm-hmm. we would engage in flogging and whips and that kind of thing. And then afterward he would, and it was very like rough and very much like him telling me what to do and saying things that, you know, in the regular world, in the outside world would be harsh. Mm-hmm. It would be harsh and it would be very emotionally abusive. Mm-hmm. But because we had created the safe container of this is our play, this is something that we are taking on these roles, then afterward, he would hold me in his arms and caress my hair and tell me that I was such a good girl. And, you know, all of these words and these actions would help sort of close the container mm-hmm. and leave me in a state of feeling held and supported rather than being left feeling not connected with and mm-hmm. by myself.
Right, right. And I think that's what a beautiful kind of example that you talked about, your personal experience, because I think it's the aftercare is so important. And I think that's why that people need to do research when they want to kind of incorporate more of kind of like BDSM in the relationship to make sure that they have this, first of all, the consent piece and also the aftercare piece, so they can help them, as you said, like this kind of interaction to close the scene. And this is something, is a tangent, which I, with the consent BDSM community, at least the clients that I've seen, they do a great job at it. They're very clear. They talk about it usually. Usually, at least, again, the people I know, kind of what is okay and what's not okay. And if you're consenting to it right now, what would be the safe word if in case you don't like it and about what's going on in the moment? Mm-hmm. But I think that makes a huge difference, because on the other side, at times I hear from friends or even colleagues or clients that the partner, the sexual partner, try to do this kind of more aggressive things spontaneously during the sex with the partner without negotiating it. Mm. And I had people, clients, and even colleagues that I felt traumatized with the partner choking them in the middle of the sex because it wasn't discussed. So I think it can definitely change the dynamic. If you are consenting to this, you might be more open to exploring different things, and your sex life might be so much more exciting if you have that element of talking and communicating around these things versus spontaneously trying to kind of explore these things during sex.
Yeah. And can't we all learn from that experience? Like, can we all learn how to communicate and have consent before we engage in sex, and continuously throughout it? Because I think that concept is across the board. It's not even just BDSM. It's just BDSM gets way better at communicating, talking about it, because the culture is so aware of it and they want to make things safe and not harming and traumatizing. But we can all use with talking about these specific things, because who knows who has trauma in their history where one sex position may completely dysregulate them. And that has nothing to do with BDSM, but simply all about that particular person's sexual script.
Absolutely. And I think if we are doing things that we haven't kind of consented or haven't talked to the partner before, that can trigger the trauma, as you mentioned. I hear it even from the married couples that they've been together for years and they're trying this new position, that kind of brings up so many kind of memory for the partner. So yeah. I think that's fantastic for everyone to have a safe word and also talk about kind of like what they like, what they want to kind of explore. And that can make sex so much more exciting, right? Because you're constantly thinking about, what am I willing to do? Like, you're doing this checking with yourself and with your partner. So it's not necessarily you're always having this routine sex.
Right. And how much more exciting that is, and how much more we can all relax into that when we know where everybody is. We don't have to guess.
Right. So I bet that, like, you sounded so exciting kind of doing the play and BDSM. And I bet some of our listeners, they want to know, like, okay, if we want to explore BDSM and we haven't done that, what would be the first kind of a starting point for them?
I would say read books or watch YouTube videos about people who are talking about their experiences of being in BDSM. A couple of my favorite authors and books, there's the new bottoming book and the new topping book by Janet Hardy and Dossie Easton. There's also the Ultimate Guide to Kink, BDSM Roleplay, and the Erotic Edge by Tristan Taramino. And then any of the work by Galen Foose. And I actually interviewed him on my own podcast as well. So all three of them are phenomenal, and the way that they write things in a way that's accessible for people and helps them expand their potential for sex in general, whether it's BDSM or not. But I think those are the first places to go so that we can rewrite the inner script or understanding that we have around BDSM in an accurate way, instead of the old scripts that say there's something mentally wrong with you.
Thank you for recommending those books. I leave the link to those books in the show notes. I haven't read them, honestly, so I'm very excited myself to read those. And Dr. Kat, I know you have your own podcast, you're a therapist. Mm-hmm. So tell us, where can people find the content, the podcast, the website, and all of those good stuff?
Sure. So my podcast is Eat, Play, Sex, and you can find that on Spotify or iTunes. It's everything related to sex, relationships, and nutrition, so especially hormone health and how we can take care of ourselves from the inside out. Everything else can be found on sexloveyoga.com. I'm also in social media, Instagram at sexloveyoga. Every day writing something related to one of those three topics. It's really fun. I also have online programs around sexuality and navigating heartbreak. So and videos on acro yoga for intimacy. Oh. So utilizing the concept of yoga to help us regulate our nervous system so that we can better connect with each other and find deeper layers of release and sensation and pleasure in our bodies.
Awesome. Awesome. I'll leave the link to the show notes to all of those great resources that you mentioned. Thank you so much for coming into the show. This was definitely a very helpful and informative conversation.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
You too.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Kat. I think it was very cool that she conducted this wonderful study around vanilla and kinky sex, and she shared her finding with us. At the end, I wanted to thank all of you guys who wrote us an honest review on iTunes. I recently got a review from Weekler. She wrote, "I'm always on the hunt to find good, accurate content about sexual wellness, and this podcast is just amazing. I learned quite a bit and recommend it to anyone in the industry wanting to get more in depth about their sexuality or for those who help others with their sexuality. I love you, V. Claire. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and experiences with other people. And thank you so much for spreading the word about this show. If you like this show, please consider recommending it to a friend and write us an honest review on iTunes. I'll talk to you guys later. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Sexology Podcast. For more great content, visit www.sexologypodcast.com. Please be advised that information presented on this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health provider.